Good morning. We're opening the Senate Revenue Committee. Committee, for the next 3 days, we have on our docket the whole issue of compliance and tax collections and really just reviewing what, and that's what we're going to do today with Director Harshenko and the Department of Revenue, reviewing what we do now in terms of getting compliance and everyone into the system of revenue collection, and also how we just getting an overview of the governor's proposals that he has in his budget for better collections and better compliance. Tomorrow we're going to have invited testimony and then go to a public hearing. We have several different proposals that will come to us tomorrow, a couple from members of the legislature dealing with an amnesty program, dealing with closing some shelters, and we'll have testimony invited from a group that is, I guess, formed just to work on this very issue, and we're going to also hear from Paul and someone from the Department of Revenue on Deborah Buchanan on Governor Schwarzenegger's program in terms of that he's rolled out in California in terms of tax compliance and collections. Then on Thursday, what I'd like to do is start looking at, we have a committee bill that relates to tax compliance, and so then I'd like to begin the process of marking up legislation and seeing if we can't put several of these ideas together, some stemming from the governor's proposals, some stemming from the proposals that we get. As I've kind of vetted them around, it seems to be an area that we'll learn in the next 2 or 3 days, an arena where you can get pretty good support of just getting better compliance and a better system to make sure everyone's participating and following the laws that we do have on the books. So that would be Thursday, would be a day for us to, as a committee, to look at drafting legislation as a committee bill and for introduction. We do have that vehicle available to us. Anything, Paul, that before we get started here?
No, Mr. Chair.
Committee? All right. Elizabeth Harshenko, the Department Director of Revenue, and Susan Browning, the Deputy Director, to give us kind of a state of the Department of Revenue and an overview.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. With me is Susan Browning, Deputy Director. And we've prepared for you a packet of information. I'm going to try to just touch on some of it. If any of the detail is of interest to you, please stop me and ask us to drill down a little bit deeper. How much time do we have? About an hour? Or how much time did you want us to spend today?
Well, you know, absent the questions that we'll probably throw you off with and take your time away from you, I would say if you could go for till 9:30, that's without all the questions that we interrupt.
Okay.
And that would be about perfect.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We appreciate the opportunity to come and meet with you and talk about how we administer state tax programs and try to achieve compliance. Going very briefly through the overview, our primary mission is to make your tax systems work. We have certain values that we use that inform us as we decide how we're going to do what it is we're going to do. So ethical standards, operational excellence, being responsible with the budget you give to us, and high-quality relationships inside and outside the department are important for us to be successful. As you can see on page 6, over the years, the department has acquired quite a few programs. The really large ones are your income tax programs, personal income and corporate income tax, and the property tax program, which we supervise and administer in partnership with the counties. Looking at page 7, this gives you just a very high-level overview of the way the agency is organized. We are organized around who the taxpayer is, and so you'll see that our personal tax and compliance division is focused on individuals. Our business division is focused on businesses. Property tax, of course, is the whole system of property tax. And then our information processing division supports the rest of the organization. It has our technology group, the processing center, human resources, and our accounting and finance office. Moving to page 8, we're going to go through a series of these arrow pages now to show you from a very high level the kinds of functions that the agency engages in to generate the revenue that we do and where those dollars go. And in the income tax programs, you can see we have a range of activities from assistance in education, because we feel that this is a voluntary system, basically. I mean, we rely on taxpayers to self-initiate. We'll send them forms, but then they have to take the time to fill them out correctly and make their payments and make sure that they're making estimated payments or informing their employers about withholding. Of course, we process returns and payments. It's probably one of the most significant functions for spending by the state is getting the money in the bank. And then the returns that we do get, we audit to make sure that they're correct. If folks owe the state money, whether it's because they've reported they owed it and didn't pay it at the time, or we've determined that they owe it, we have collection activity. And then filing enforcement is identifying and locating taxpayers who should be filing returns and paying taxes but who are not, and bringing them into the system, getting them into compliance and for past years, and hopefully getting them in the habit of complying on their own initiative going forward. The personal and corporate income taxes fund about 95% of the general fund. And we have our pie chart that shows you where the dollars go, and I know you're all very, very much aware of where those dollars go. Page 10. Same sort of information about our property tax system. Our role there is both as supervisor of the system, establishing standards for the county so that the property tax system is administered as uniformly as possible across the state in compliance with the Constitution. We also provide services in evaluation of property that's very complicated to determine the value of. So industrial property that's worth $1 million or more, the department determines values and certifies those values to the counties, and then utility and transportation property. So electronics plants, food processing plants, manufacturing operations, communications, power, and air and rail are the areas in which we do valuation and certify those values out. We also partner with the county to make sure that the base mapping system is up to the quality and standards that it needs to be, and we're trying to move into a digital state property tax map, which I'll talk about just a little bit later. Administration oversight includes training, standards, and a lot of advice, both in person, on the phone, and written, to the county tax collectors and assessors so that they're sure that they're administering the law accurately. And then we're also responsible for determining the value of forest land across the state. Property tax dollars, of course, go into local governments, schools, cities, counties, special districts, urban renewal districts, and fund the services that you see on page 11. The tobacco program is the second or third largest program that we administer. Some years it's corporate tax, some years it's tobacco. But there again, we're responsible for processing, banking, and collecting revenue, auditing returns, inspecting retailers to make sure that products are stamped and the taxes are paid. And then through the Department of Revenue, we contract for services from the State Police and the Department of Justice for law enforcement support in the compliance effort. And the department is a partner in a task force with those other two agencies for achieving compliance. And you can see where those dollars go. Then on pages 14 and 15, you'll see the other major programs that we administer for you and where those where the dollars go. Some of them are very specialized. Some of them are not. Some go into the general fund. Some have other dedicated destinations. We also, looking at page 16, provide collection services for others. We have a unit that collects debt for other state agencies, and we have, I think it's over 270 customers who receive services from that unit, both in terms of full collection activity as well as offset against income tax refunds. We collect fines and assessments for the court system, and we, under contract with TriMet and the Lane Transit District, collect transit taxes. And finally, we administer two programs that are connected to the tax system, but they aren't your traditional tax program. One is a payment program for low-income elderly that renters, and the idea of the funds was to assist them in paying that embedded property tax cost that's in their rent, and also a funded property tax exemption for nonprofit homes for the elderly. And then we administer the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program, by which the state pays property taxes on behalf of certain seniors who are below a certain income and asset level. The state takes a lien on their home. Then when the home is sold or the individual dies and the property goes through their estate, then those property taxes are repaid. So that's a self-funding program that it's a revolving loan program, basically, for seniors to defer property taxes. Susan's going to give you an overview of our business plan and start to talk to you about the basics of our approach to the income tax system.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning. I'm Deputy Director of Department of Revenue. As Elizabeth said, we're starting on page 18 here. Just to give you an overview of our business plan for the department, this is a pretty new product for us that we are using to guide us through the next 4 years, and we'll be working on it for the 0509 biennium shortly here as well. The plan is really based on the governor's principles around accountability, responsiveness, and good tax administration, and also we've taken into account statewide initiatives, and also with a lot of bottom-up approach from the department and the staff on what we should be doing and what we should be planning for to try to anticipate and then also move the tax programs forward. I have some highlights here I wanted to share with you to give you a sense of what's in there. We've done it by completed, underway, and then some future projects that we have out there that we're going to be working on. The completed ones I've mentioned here, we have paying your taxes, your current year taxes, by credit card. That's new this tax season, so that's an advantage for taxpayers and also for us, we think, because if people can pay upfront on their credit cards, we're hopeful that they will not need payment plans or need collection action for the department. So that's a really good thing for both sides of it. The other piece that I mentioned here is where's my refund? Taxpayers will be able to go online and check the status of their pending refund. This is another customer service piece for taxpayers, but we also, the department has a real vested interest in doing this because we get many, many calls from taxpayers every season who are checking every couple weeks to see if their refund is getting closer. So this will divert some of those phone calls for people so they can use the web and check it for themselves. So that's really a nice tool.
Yeah.
We also have a website. Elizabeth mentioned the Oregon Map Project. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. We also have a website of that information and has links to the counties so that you can see the maps for the counties as well. Underway, electronic exchange of data with the counties and our partners in the property tax program. We're working on that piece to cut down the flow of paper and more timely response. And two of the big projects that we have, you see it's the second and third bullets underway, are replacing the personal income tax system. That's a very elaborate and very large system that does all the processing and also has all the information, names, addresses, social securities, numbers, that sort of thing for taxpayers. So that's almost complete. That's going to be done in September of 2005, the rewrite of those. So we've been working on that for several years and really excited about bringing it up. It has some real efficiency pieces in it as well. So part of that we've offered as part of the governor's balanced budget a reduction of our staff for efficiencies, and a lot of the efficiencies are what we expect to gain out of this rewrite here. So a nice touch. Future projects, one of the big ones we're working on with other agencies is a central business registry where employers will be able to come in and meet the filing and reporting initial requirements for several state agencies in one spot. And then Elizabeth will be talking a little bit more with you about the Multi-State Tax Commission and their work, and I think you're going to hear about that a little bit tomorrow as well. So stay tuned for that, a little bit more information on that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Pozanski.
Just going back onto the completed task, the pay taxes by credit card, online or by phone, that's an option as compared to being a mandatory means of payment?
You bet. Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski, totally voluntary. Okay. It's actually through a third-party vendor, so that if the taxpayer wants to use that option, they would agree and work it through the third party. So the state's not paying the credit card fee. The taxpayer would be doing it. Paying the fee up front. We're delighted to have taxpayers send in their checks, send in their money. Just an option.
Just want to do it.
If they want to do it with credit card. It's a nice touch for people to do that.
Okay.
We're going to start on page 19. We talk about the balanced approach to healthy income tax programs. That's a theme that we really use with our employees, is that there's three pillars, and you'll see those on page 20, that we emphasize with our employees that it is a voluntary system. It's voluntary compliance, and our business is compliance. In order to achieve the full program benefit, we really emphasize education, assistance, and enforcement. The education piece, really, part of that is sharing how your tax dollars are used and trying to promote the sense of ownership among taxpayers that they do support Oregon's public services, and their money is used well and for good services, whether it's state troopers or teachers, all of those type of things. So that's part of what we target, as well as explaining responsibilities.
How do the education programs manifest themselves?
How do they manifest themselves? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have those little charts that you saw earlier. We have those actually available and distribute those through our field offices and do outreach pieces. We actually have a student website that's available for high school students to learn more about how to file and how their money is being used. And we talk with the schools about using that as part of their curriculum if it's appropriate. So trying to share that information as widely as we can.
Have we incorporated that into our tax forms? I thought one year maybe we did, where it had the little pie graph of where your state income tax dollar goes.
Mm-hmm.
Have we done that consistently, or was that a one time or a no time, and I just thought we did it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have put it in different years. We've put it in several years, I believe, and then we've been trying to target different areas, like where it goes towards public safety or where it goes to education, with a little bit more of explanation about it. So we have tried to get out the information as broadly as we can through our outreach.
Refund checks, too.
Well, refund checks have a little information about how your tax dollars are being used. That's one of our links to the Oregon benchmarks, and one of the areas where we feel real strongly that long-term, if taxpayers understood and felt that connection with their tax system, maybe we would have fewer issues with people who aren't filing and paying as they should.
Well, just in the area of branding, and Paul, maybe we put this on our list of things, is that we consistently say the same thing. Maybe we consistently give that graph where the 96% of state income tax dollars go to the three big areas. That might be just a consistent everything we do continues to at least provide that information, because the state budget has changed so dramatically from what we did 10 years ago to what we do today.
You bet, Mr. Chair. I think it's surprising as we talk to taxpayers how much of the money is actually going towards education. People really have not kept up, I don't think, intellectually with the switch from off of property tax into the income tax and what that means as far as what your state income tax is being used for now. It's surprising. People go, yeah, that's really right. That's important. I want to pay for state police. I want to pay for the schools. And you bet, I can see why I should be paying my taxes. So that's part of what we do in the education arena. Assistance really gets out to trying to help people understand how to comply, whether it's providing help with filling out the tax returns or literally looking at our forms to try to make them more easily usable and that kind of thing. And that's where we target assistance. Enforcement, we talked about that a little bit at the beginning. The pieces within that are auditing returns for accuracy, collecting payments if people have not sent in the full amount or if we find they owe more, and actually what we call filing enforcement, which is identifying people who have not filed and we believe should file, and then trying to determine how much they owe. We estimate their income, and then we estimate, based on that income, how much tax we believe they should pay. And we share a lot of information from the IRS to develop that. So we'll talk a little bit more about filing enforcement, because it sounds like that might be something of interest to the committee specifically.
Mm-hmm.
On page 21, that little diagram that outlines basically the use of those three concepts. Education and assistance really supports the voluntary reporting piece that's on the far left-hand, on the left-hand side. If people voluntarily report and pay the money that they owe, it goes right into the bank. They're good for another year, so we're all set. If they voluntarily report, but they cannot pay the full amount, then it comes back into our accounts receivable, and we will work with the taxpayer on payment plans or other mechanisms to collect that money.
Do we know, and sorry to interrupt you, do we know what percentage or ballpark what percentage don't voluntarily report?
Don't voluntarily report? We can get some numbers for you, Senator Echo. We'll look at that. We've looked at it from the amount of money. As far as looking at it from the amount of money that's not coming in that we believe should be coming in, it ranges. It's really a difficult estimate to come up with, but we think it's about 9%
as far as
dollars.
9% of the total dollars.
Dollars coming in.
We don't know what percentage of the people.
Right.
You would guess it would be roughly around there are just not.
It's hard
compliant.
To determine it. The 9% includes the money that's not coming in, whether through inaccurate reporting, not reported at all as far as income goes, some of those things. So that's mm-hmm. the total, what we call the tax gap, the difference between what we think should be coming in versus the amount of money received.
Okay. Thanks.
It's hard to pin that back to numbers of taxpayers. We've done some real ballpark figures, but it's hard to get what you don't know, you know.
Yeah. The 9% is helpful. I mean, it might be helpful for us to also, and we wouldn't hold you to the number, but just get a sense of, for our information, what percentage of the people are not voluntarily participating in the system.
Mm-hmm. We could certainly look at that, Mr. Chair. The other piece that feeds into the accounts receivable is our work in auditing returns, and you can see that coming in, auditing for accuracy, and then filing compliance. We've talked about that a little bit, that identifying people who should be filing a warrant coming in. And so those are the dollars that we have out there to actually collect from our revenue agents. Okay, page 22 talks really about how we collect the income tax dollars within the state of Oregon. We've mentioned the importance of voluntary compliance, and you can really see it on this chart, that 85% of the dollars come in through the withholding and estimated tax system, so people paying their taxes during the year. About 13% is actually paid with the return, and then 2% we get through our audit and collection work. Page 23, I wanted to put this in here. This code, Quality and Compliance Code of Conduct, this is what we use as our standard for our staff and the income tax programs. It was developed by our staff and is based on best practices of our employees, and it really does emphasize how we want our employees to work with taxpayers, respectfully, honesty, integrity, and those type of things. So this is posted everywhere, and we talk with employees about it because we want to make sure that we do our job well. We need to treat people very well as part of that, too. Whether it's coworkers, taxpayers, those we come in contact with. Page 24, in the interest of time, we'll kind of skim over some of these things, but please feel free to stop me at any time here. I want to keep you on schedule here. Page 24 is the outreach. We talked about education and assistance. We do have field offices throughout the state, and their primary purpose is to allow to give taxpayers an avenue to come in and talk with people in the field offices and have some direct contact. We found that some taxpayers really do not feel comfortable dealing with their tax matters over the phone. They would really like to have someone to sit down and talk with them about it, especially if they have a really troubling problem that they need some advice. So the field offices provide that role. You can see we have one or two-person offices in what we call our satellite offices as well. They meet with the taxpayers directly. They also provide a lot of the education and outreach that we talked about. They participate in community events, participate in some of the tax preparation projects in the different areas. We also provide seminars on business taxes, and we also provide information for non-English speaking taxpayers because they do have an obligation to file and report, but oftentimes it's very difficult for them to understand what's involved with that.
a lot of the debate has been in the last few years, especially, you've probably seen it spike, is do we have enough folks out there, not just in the field, but here also in Salem, and are they well-trained enough to help with both the education and the compliance? What is your feeling in terms of both adequate numbers and trained well enough to really get the education and compliance in done?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we really emphasize the training. We see it as a partnership. We really need to partner with the tax aid group that provides free tax preparation, the community groups. We really don't believe that, you know, the state could ever have enough resources to do it all directly itself. We really need to work with the local community people, with the schools, and really make those connections and have good information out so that we can try to build that network and do it. As I mentioned, as far as staffing goes, it's a balance. We really try to balance the education assistance and enforcement piece among the three and do it as wisely and as accurately as we can for you so that we keep the costs, our administration costs, low, because our costs are coming from the general fund. So the more you put into our administrative costs, the less money you have for other programs. So we're really aware of trying to do that efficiently. So I think really the answer I would say is I think our training's good. We really emphasize it a lot. We try to take advantage of the different leveraging it with other community groups and having that interest in those networks out there.
So is that an area that we can improve upon, both the number and the training, to see better, to whittle away at that 9% that is the gap?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that, Mr. Chair, that we've seen that's, I think, been a little bit disappointing is the state, the school budgets, you know, have been tighter and tighter. There are fewer public finance classes or finance requirements in the schools. There used to be a better connection in with the schools to present it to, like, high school students, and now we're trying to find other avenues, but it's not a requirement. So that's one area we've seen that's been a little bit challenging. Trying to work with non-English-speaking taxpayers has been a little bit of a challenge, too, but I think we're doing really well on that. We could sure come back with some ideas, see if there's any areas we can think of. I don't know.
Well, I'm just not getting an answer to this, and maybe the department just doesn't.
I can't think of anything offhand right now, Mr. Chair, as far as areas, as far as additional staff we would need or legislation.
Mr. Chair, we've got three policy option packages in our budget, in the governor's recommended budget. One of the challenges for any organization is growing at a rate at which you can absorb the growth and manage it well and not just have so many people running around that they really aren't effective. So we plan on the audit side, we plan audit classes so that we can bring people in and train them all together and get them all started together and integrated in with senior auditors so that they have the mentoring that they need. With our collectors, we try to do the same thing, bring in enough a group of people and then really focus some training for them. If we get these option packages, we'll go out and try and recruit people as a group and bring them in. And then we also do ongoing training, especially with the staff that deals with the public, so that they're up to date on tax law changes. They're up to date on all of the resources that taxpayers have in order to comply. So as Susan said, we really do for the staff that's dealing with the public. There's a lot of training that we invest in them. We're kind of reaching the limits of the building that we're in, and so to add additional staff now requires us to also find additional space. Mm-hmm. And so just the logistics of that is makes it just a little more challenging. We did add a field office after the 2003 legislative session in Gresham to deal with the growth in population in East County and also to take some of the east side of the mountains off the shoulders of our Bend office, because they were trying to actually handle Central and Eastern Oregon pretty much alone. So we're trying to use the staff that you give us as strategically as possible, make sure that they have the resources that they need, both in terms of training and then immediate resources available, you know, good, knowledgeable managers. And then we have a lot of resource online for folks.
So the answer is no, we're good.
Mr. Chair, I think for where we are right now, mm-hmm. with these policy option packages, if they're approved, and we can bring those people in effectively and get them working effectively and efficiently, as promptly as possible. Anything more would be a real managerial challenge that could you know, dilute the effectiveness of the group. So we try, when we're doing those sorts of things, to think about how many can we take in and use well right away, and phase that over time.
Great.
But we're always trying to think about how do we maximize the strategies that we use.
Right, right now. Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Chair, I think we're on page 25. We talked a little bit about this. This is the areas of compliance, filing enforcement, collection audit. We have developed a new filing enforcement system in 0507 we're working on. It's scheduled to be coming up very soon. Collections, we've modified our process so we get demand letters out more quickly to taxpayers so that they realize the importance and the severity of the issue that they're dealing with. And then we've talked a little bit about our audit tool that we have, too. So we really use a lot of technology. Elizabeth touched upon that a little bit as far as the education assistance. We're trying to get more information out on the web and out to taxpayers that way. We're also trying to use technology as efficiently as we can in our compliance area. On page 26, we've primarily been talking about personal income tax. There's some information on page 26 about our corporation taxes. And there's in the interest of time, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the total billings you see for one fiscal year are about $33 million. So corporation is a major source of taxes within the state of Oregon as well.
Just a question on that while we're there. So one of the proposals we're going to, or a couple of them we're going to hear around, is around the arena of where firms will market to some of our companies shelters that really don't exist or are stretching the law on how to close those shelters. Does the department, I know you'll have representatives here tomorrow when we hear about those, but do you have thoughts? I know you've been down to California to at least talk to them about what they're endeavoring upon in this arena. Do you have thoughts on Oregon-specific legislation dealing with some of these shelters that perhaps don't even exist but are being used as shelters?
Well, we do have, Mr. Chair, we have a policy option package to provide more resources to work on that area with the abusive tax avoidance transactions. And Elizabeth wants to talk a little bit about it, too.
We've been partnering with other states for the last year in a two-phase process. One has been information gathering and learning about the use of abusive tax shelters, both by businesses and by individuals. Both California and New York have taken the lead in informing and educating the rest of the states. It's been a great partnership because the smaller states that don't have the kind of resources that those big states have really couldn't bring this up from ground zero. And so those two states are sharing databases. They're sharing applications that they've developed to try to identify shelter vehicles and the relationships between different returns. One of the things that we've seen is that the availability of limited liability entities, limited liability corporations and limited liability partnerships, which are not required to file tax returns and pay tax, has created a whole opportunity for moving money around and hiding it that didn't exist before those entities were allowed to be created under law. So that's been quite a challenge, and so we've got a big partnership going there nationally with a lot of states participating. Susan mentioned the policy option package to give us some more resources to take what we've learned and apply it here, and there will probably be more detail for you tomorrow on precisely what it is we're focused on. But the thing that really is gratifying is that the states really are coming together around these issues.
Mm, great. And we'll invite, obviously, when we get the proposals tomorrow, both yours and the other ones, we'll obviously invite your perspective as we draft them into a bill.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question on that?
Senator Metzger.
Since you talked about that issue, I would be interested in your perspective. And then, as we talk through the week, you may want to provide some additional information. But in terms of the ability to, as the chair was talking about, these phantom organizations or other entities designed to take away tax liability that otherwise would exist, I'm curious where the department is from the director's standpoint. where you are in utilities, because in this very committee 2 years ago, we were talking about Portland General Electric and Enron, and much has come out even since then, that a great deal of the profit anticipated by this utility is their ability to convert tax dollars into profit dollars. When we had this before the committee, because the PUC regulation allows the entity to collect tax dollars from ratepayers based on being a non-consolidated entity, that's how rates are set. And then we allow them to file consolidated returns, which basically then allows those dollars never to go to the state. And while the PUC and consumer groups were supportive of the collection and the payment should be on the same form, if you're allowed to collect on a non-consolidated basis, you have to pay on a non-consolidated basis. The ones who came in and dumped on that was the Department of Revenue in that hearing, and that legislation never moved. And since that time, $30 million more has been collected by Oregon ratepayers that never went to the state treasury. And I'm wondering if the Department of Revenue has rethought their position on that issue, because this is a unique situation in which you give actually tax-collecting power from an entity for citizens, and this is part of the whole game plan of being able to provide to a bottom line without any really intent to ever deliver those dollars to either the U.S. Treasury or the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the issue that you're talking about is a complex one. And the concern that I think we had 2 years ago was that the legislature set up a filing requirement for business entities that requires them, if they file a consolidated federal return, to file a consolidated return for state purposes and to look at the nature of the business enterprise and determine how much of the income and expense of the business enterprise is fairly attributable to the state. I understand the concern that you've expressed and that we talked about 2 years ago, that for that particular example, there was a local corporation trying to estimate how much tax it would pay based upon what it knows about its own income and expenses, reporting that in good faith to the PUC, and then that being built into a rate structure. What a subsidiary company usually doesn't know is what's going on in the rest of the in the rest of the enterprise, and the consolidated return, of course, is the responsibility of the parent company. So the way it works for the regulated rate setting requires the company to anticipate, try to predict based upon what it knows about its own situation, and not take into account, probably because it may not be able to, operations of related companies in a corporate family that are going on across the country. Their states choose each of those different approaches. Some states are what are called separate accounting states or separate reporting states, where every corporation, every corporate entity reports on a standalone basis. Those states lose a substantial amount of revenue because as soon as you allow corporations that are essentially conducting a single business enterprise to allocate income and expenses to other corporations in the family, it disappears. It goes to states where there is no corporate income tax. The only defense the states have against that is using the consolidated or combined reporting process, where we say, if you're part of a family, part of an enterprise, the income that's generated in Oregon is going to be determined based upon the activities of the entire business enterprise conducted everywhere, apportioned in part to Oregon, so that the shell game of moving income and expenses around can't understate the amount of income or expense attributable to Oregon. We've talked a lot with the PUC during the interim about the challenge of what they need to do in order to regulate and provide a fair return and predict expenses for a company in a rate case, and how companies then report at after tax years are over what their liability is on a consolidated basis, and it's complicated. There really aren't any easy solutions. I think the concern we articulated 2 years ago was if the legislature were to decide to shift away from that general rule of consolidated reporting to a general rule of separate reporting, you would lose more than you would gain overall.
Well, and just because this will be something we can hear about later, because this bill will be, I think, from Senator Walker is coming to this committee. So just kind of a heads up on that, but and I won't belabor the issue in a moment, other than to throw it out there so we could have further discussions. But I think it's really, really important in issues like this to differentiate between businesses in general and regulated utilities, because you're talking about that general concept of businesses. We're talking about a utility provides heat and electric service, which in statute is defined as in the general public interest and has been given broad authority to collect from its customers, unlike other businesses. And the PUC before the Business and Economic Development Committee 2 weeks ago when we conducted hearings on what the state's role should be, the PUC made it very clear that this was a revenue issue, not a regulatory issue. And so we have to deal with that, with the revenue issue and what is proper, because they are a different animal than any other businesses. So with that, Mr. Chair, just I mean, we're going to be discussing that in this committee, but we need to solve this problem fairly and equitably, both for the utilities, the ratepayers, and the citizens who are paying taxes and believing that they're going to the benefit of the state through the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, and we look forward to working with you to try and resolve this one, because it is thorny. I think it's got both aspects to it, and the solution isn't just on the regulatory side or just on the revenue side. I think there's got to be some integration of the concepts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Chairman Beyer he's been working on it, has a white paper draft that he's going to present to this committee in the next week or two, just on this very issue, and that should give us a recommended path that they have worked on for regulated utilities. We'll be interested. Obviously, I know you guys have been involved in some degree in the drafting of that proposal.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we've tried to provide as much technical assistance as we can to the PUC. I think I've seen a draft of that paper, and it does come from the regulatory point of view. What are the options? What are the constraints? What are the upside and downside risks of changing the way that the regulator looks at a tax expense?
Well, then we'll want, given that comment, we'll want to have your representative here when we have Chairman Beyer.
You bet.
Just to give us the Department of Revenue perspective, so that we have, I guess, both sides of that coin here when we get their recommendations.
We'll be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, page 28, we just have some quick facts about our processing. And give you kind of a feel for the scope of what we do. You can see under the second tax returns filed, you can really see the growth of electronic filing and 2D barcoding. 2D barcoding is simply when we scan returns. Some taxpayers are not quite ready to go the full electronic filing. They still want to do electronically they want to use the software on their PC, and then they want to print out the paper and mail it to us. So there's now software programs that allow them to print out the returns with all of the information coded up on the top, so all we have to do is scan it. So it's a very, very inexpensive way for us to do our work. So that's kind of an example of some of the technology pieces that we use as we go through. And I think you see the growth of the electronic funds transfer and how important that is to us. And then we've got some information on the days to deposit the funds. And electronic funds transfer really helps us get money into the Treasury very fast. With that, we're going to turn it over to property tax, and you're going to be starting on page 29 and talk to Ms. Elizabeth a little bit about that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, to ask for some direction, would you like me to give you an overview of the property tax administration and cigarette tax, or would you like to jump right into the policy option packages?
Thank you for that question. You know, cigarette taxes, and this is for the committee, when I've talked to Representative Butler, who's the chair of House Revenue, he's interested in that arena, and so I think we'll punt on that. If we start a bill over here, it's going to go directly to Representative Butler. So on cigarette, I think my preference would be for us to just skip that, since he's done such great work in that arena. And then property tax is also an area that I think you could give us a couple minutes, but that's not really where we're focused, and the policy option package is really interesting.
All right, let me just give you a couple minutes on property tax. This is the biggest system in at the local level that funds schools and local government, and what we've tried to give you is just a flavor for The way in which we partner with the counties to support the work that they do so that that system works well, and that's on page 30. And then page 31, to just show you sort of the change in the system. When I started working for the state in the Attorney General's office advising the Department of Revenue, the property tax system was reasonably simple. The assessor determined the real market value of property. The taxing units figured out what their budget was, informed the assessor how much they needed from the property tax system. You divided what was needed into the total value, produced a rate, and then spread the amount of the budget back over the taxable property. When Measure 5 was passed, limits were placed on the amount of tax that could be imposed on any particular property to $5 per $1,000 of value for education and $10 per $1,000 for general government. And then when Measure 50 was enacted, the value itself was rolled back and the growth in value was constrained to 3% per year. Tax rates were permanently fixed. And Measure 5 still applies. So we've got a lot more complexity in the system that the assessors and tax collectors are dealing with and that we're trying to support. Pages 32 and 33, we just show you of the budget that we have and the budget that the counties have, how much is spent on the different functions. Valuation is the biggest single chunk, I think, for both, both partners and... you can see mapping and tax collection also are significant to the counties. We, for the department's part, looking at page 36, the centrally assessed property roll, which is the telecommunications and power companies, airlines, and railroads, that tax roll every year is about $12.2 billion in value. The industrial properties that we value, that roll each year is about $16.6 billion in value. And those values are all certified to the counties for preparation of tax bills. The mapping program I mentioned is significant because without accurate maps, you're not going to have an accurate property tax system. We provide maintenance services to 14 counties, and you can see those on the map on page 37. We train the county cartographers, assist with conversion of paper maps to digital, and we're working on trying to make all of our maps available on the internet, both for tax administration and for taxpayers. If you look at pages 38 and 39, there's a summary of our Oregon Map Project, which was funded, I believe, in 1999 through a $1 per document recording fee at the local level. We get right around $1 million a year coming in, which we then turn around and grant out to the counties for improving their systems. And the goal for the program is that all assessor's map will be maintained digitally and in a format that can be used for other geographic information system applications beyond just the tax system by 2008. I'm going to skip tobacco taxes, and we're going to move into those policy option packages, which are on page 44. We've talked a lot about willful tax avoidance in our conversation today, and the governor has recommended that the department be given $2.6 million additional resources to hire some more people to generate some additional revenue and shutting down some of those tax shelters and doing more audit work. We've also seen a pretty substantial growth in our accounts receivable over the past few years, fueled in part by locating taxpayers who haven't filed and who need to be filing and getting into the system. And so the governor has recommended to the legislature that we'd be given some additional positions to generate some additional revenue there. And then I mentioned early on that we collect debt owed to other state agencies, and our other agency accounts unit has not been increased for many, many years. Their accounts receivable and the number of accounts referred from our customer agencies has grown dramatically, and so we've asked for a pretty significant enhancement in that group. The costs of collecting for other agencies are paid by those agencies out of the collections that we generate for them. So those are the three big policy option packages that we have on the budget side. Our Ways and Means hearings start next week.
Just a question on the receivables. Have you all stated a formal position in terms of amnesty programs? It's something we're going to look at tomorrow is introducing an amnesty program in Oregon, and I don't know if the department is monitoring that or going to tell us tomorrow that we think it's a good idea and this is how we would structure it.
Well, Mr. Chair, we've observed what's gone on around the country. Almost all the states have gone through amnesty programs in the last 4 years or so, some for the second or third time.
Mm-hmm.
The issues that you'll want to consider are whether you'd collect those dollars anyway, whether we think how much we think might actually be generated since we have put so much energy into filing enforcement and compliance since 1989. But if you decide that it's in the best interest of the state to do an amnesty program, we will do our very best to administer it for you so it's successful.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to take a position that it's good or bad. It's just we'd like to be sure that we partner with you so that if you decide you want to do one, it's designed in a way that it can be as successful as possible.
So as I've looked at the other states, and not nearly as conclusive or in-depth as probably you have, it seems to me, I mean, California is the great hurrah story, but it seems to me that they have been working to bring in excess of what they were predicting they would bring in terms of amnesty.
Well, it's been difficult for states to predict because, as Susan mentioned, you don't know what you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in California with their voluntary compliance initiative, which you will discuss tomorrow, it was a very targeted effort to focus on taxpayers who might have taken advantage of some of the more interesting abusive tax shelter programs. So they targeted very, very high-income individuals and businesses with a direct communication campaign. They estimated about one-tenth of what they actually got. And I think as I talked to the California administrator, he was stunned at how many taxpayers came forward and how many dollars were generated out of that. But it was really a fairly small number relative to the population of California.
Mm-hmm.
The general amnesties that are that have been run in other states have been much broader based, and the kinds of things the states decide they want to do or deal with is, do you want to grant an amnesty only for those people that we don't know about, so that folks who maybe misreported on their return and haven't been audited and come forward voluntarily, or people who haven't filed and we haven't identified and located and contacted come forward and voluntarily file? Or do you want to accelerate collections and grant some sort of penalty or interest reprieve for people that we already know about?
Mm-hmm.
So you're just going to have to make those policy decisions and guide us on how you want it conducted.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I know that other tax administrators have told me is that you really need to advertise well and give people some time to think about it and then act. And folks will wait until close to the end of the amnesty period. We've seen them running anywhere from 30 to 90 days. Most of them seem to be 45 to 60. The other thing that we've learned from other states, and again, this is something that's very different in Oregon, we don't have a sales tax. A lot of the dollars that have come in have been from small business that has not reported sales tax. They've collected, and they've reported it and remitted sales tax to the states, the sales tax states. States that have all three taxes, property sales and income, often spend a significant amount of resource on sales tax compliance and not as much on their income tax. We have no sales tax, so we really focus on income tax compliance. So those are things that are going to affect our ability to predict for you mm-hmm. how much revenue might actually come in. The choices you make about which target group you're aimed at, people we don't know about or people we don't know about and do know about, mm-hmm. And the fact that it's pretty much just the income tax.
Mm-hmm.
You have to decide also individual or individual and corporate.
Mm-hmm. It's not authoritative, but the word I got just chatting with probably five or six CPAs last night was certainly the California effort with the high-income individuals and the businesses, and these are folks that's primarily their clients,
mm-hmm.
Would be worth looking into and replicating in Oregon based on their just anecdotal, and it's not scientific because it was just six CPAs, but based on their work with their clients, that is an effective means to help some of their clients come back, small sampling, but one that certainly got my attention last night.
Now, Mr. Chair, I know that in our income tax area, folks have been looking at that question. Hmm. We've been in close contact with California. They have given us a tremendous amount of time to share what exactly they did, what kind of follow-up they had in place, ready to go, because if people don't think you're going to follow up, they aren't going to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then how they developed their sample of the group of taxpayers that they focused on. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a group here that's trying to do the same thing, look at our demographics and figure out sort of what's the potential volume and then what kind of strategy would we use. So that's been ongoing, and folks are aimed at trying to get that figured out.
Well,
I think February was the target month for getting those answers because we knew you'd be concerned about it.
Well, we've set Thursday as a day to start at least drafting, so we'll definitely need your assistance if that's the direction we had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, the very last item that we have in the report is just a highlight of the work that we do with the Multi-State Tax Commission. I had the privilege of serving as the chair of this commission for 2.5 years, and it's an intergovernmental organization. The Oregon belongs because of a statute that was passed in 1967. We participate in a joint audit program with other states. We jointly fund staff that's very highly trained in doing audits of very large corporations, and we take advantage of that audit program. There's also a program for Nexus non-filers, corporate non-filers, to identify companies that have enough business activity in the states and ought to be filing. And there's a voluntary disclosure program that's very successful that's helped us get folks in the system, get companies in the system. We have had several special projects over the last 3 or 4 years, the most recent being a review of compliance challenges, development of recommendations and tools for the states to use to address compliance issues in the 21st century, and now the states are working on some technology-based solutions for sharing information because some of the transactions that come under that heading of abusive tax avoidance transactions occur on returns that are filed in a lot of different states, and the data has to be matched up in order to figure out what's happening. So the commission is at the forefront in doing that work. And that's our presentation. If there are any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, we'd be happy to come back anytime you do have questions.
Yes.
Well, I think we'll do both. We'd like to have your continued participation in our efforts here, but I think we might have a few questions for you before we're finished. And thank you very much for indulging us this morning on an important topic. Questions, Senator Brzezinski?
Mr. Chair, I don't know who else may have received. I received a set of questions from a tax assistance tax group that they wanted to pose to the department. And what I'd like to do is just submit to them the set of questions so they can respond to them instead of, it's actually 2 pages of stuff. So I think it would be maybe more fair to the department, and we probably would get fuller answers if we did it that way. I'm not sure what the chair wants. I know that they made the rounds, so I'm not sure if anyone else was planning on asking these questions, but I just thought give them the heads up that we need to get responses in a timely way.
Mm-hmm.
If that's all with the chair.
Sure, sure. And if you have particulars of that 2 pages, that you're more interested than not, maybe highlighting the ones that seem the most interesting to you.
Okay.
That might help the department manage that workload.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you walk us through, so you have a delinquent account, can you walk us through how you deal with that business or individual that either, I guess on one end, you know is not filing, or on the other end, is just simply having a hard time making it, and then how we deal with them after a certain period of time has elapsed and continued to not be able to pay. So I guess you have two instances. One is someone that's just not participating in the system, and the second one is someone that is participating but just having a tough time. And what are our, I guess, the carrots and sticks that we provide to to both of those?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Susan because before she became the deputy, she was the administrator of the Personal Tax and Compliance Division and kind of came up through the collection side of the agency.
Great.
Mr. Chair, well, let's take someone who can't pay in full. Mm-hmm. They've already reported they can't pay in full. Mm-hmm. Basically, we will send them out a billing, just reminding them to pay, and they will ask them to contact us. Hopefully, we will ask for payment in full first, because we don't want to have the state be the finance mechanism for it. If they can't pay in full, we will set them up for a payment plan. And if they don't contact us, we will send them a demand letter, basically saying we're going to be moving towards legal action against you if you don't contact us and work through it. And then there's time periods that run for all of these. And then we will send out a garnishment letter, basically. And a warrant and garnishment if we're still not successful. And basically what that does is we have administrative warrant authority for the department. So we can go out and garnish paychecks. We can go out and garnish checking, banking accounts. And we can also place liens if we record the warrant against personal or real property, against their homes and that type of thing. So usually the demand letter gets most people's attention. They realize the severity of it. You know, many times people are having other kind of financial problems and just need a little bit more time and are kind of stalling for time. But once they realize we're starting legal action, they will come forward. And then we can either hopefully work it out through a pay plan, because we really want people to come forward and do it. But if not, there's some people we garnish every month for quite a period of time until they actually have their debt paid. If we're not successful getting the taxpayer to come forward to deal with us, we will keep doing this over a period of time. If by statute, if it's been 1 year with no payment on the account, that account then is turned over to a private collection agency. And that was House Bill 34509 several sessions back. And then we work with the private collection agency to place that account. And they will go after collection at that stage. If it's one of our non-filers, basically what we do on non-filing is that we have database of information. If the person's a wage earner, works for an employer, it's much easier for us to figure out how much income the person has and to assess them as far as the amount of tax they have owing. We will get information from the employers and from other sources to determine what we think the person's income is, and then we will notify them that based on what we think your withholding is, this is all an estimate. We have to use the best knowledge we have available. We will set up an assessment, what we call a billing for that person, and send it out to them. It's the taxpayer's responsibility to get back to us and tell us that that's not correct. And if they don't, then that assessment becomes final after a period of time, and that's the tax they owe. We will consider at any time if they come forward with a return what's really their income, what's really their withholding status, that type of thing. We'll consider that and then adjust their taxes accordingly. But if they don't, we will go after collection, and it follows the same process. We will go out with a garnishment. Those type of people who are not filing voluntarily and paying, we really usually have to get the money through garnishment. But we really want them to come into compliance themselves, so we're not having to do this every year. There are some people that, you know, they just don't want to file. They don't want to pay. And so we have to kind of do it the hard way. But for those people who've just fallen out of the system, which is the majority of the people. A lot of people just procrastinate. They've had a divorce or illness or lost their jobs, and their taxes just became a burden. And once you go 1 year without filing, the fear factor sets in for some people, too, that, you know, I'm scared to resolve this. So we really encourage people to come forward, work with us. We can work out payment plans. We can get you back in the system so you're not going to have to face this again. And that's the majority of the people that we work with. But there are some people that are pretty hardcore, And those are the people that are out on our accounts receivable, a lot of them. That some people don't believe that they have to pay taxes. They don't believe in the system itself. There was a whole series of people, these tax promoters, kind of on an individual level. The vulture in eagle's clothing, I mean, some of you may have heard of some of those, that were actually the IRS to punish some of those people, and they're now in jail. But some of our Oregonian taxpayers believed some of this rhetoric and got into this idea where they didn't have to pay taxes. And they got so far behind that it was very, very difficult for us to get them back into compliance. So we're dealing with that far end down there with the filing enforcement, but the bulk of the taxpayers are people who just have fallen out and need to come back in. But we do have field agents in our field offices that go out and personally visit with taxpayers as well, and we'll meet them in their homes or their offices and talk about their responsibility. And we do have fairly aggressive tools we can take. If you have not filed for 3 years in a row, you're subject to 100% penalty. So that's pretty serious. That's one of the things that we talk about with amnesty, too, is Oregon does have pretty severe penalties already for people who don't file and pay. And we can waive that if the person voluntarily comes forward. So there's incentives out there as well to come forward voluntarily. Self-employed filing enforcement is another piece we work with. That's really difficult because of many times the cash transaction basis that self-employed people have. They pay a lot of their bills by cash. There's not a very good record of how much income they really have been receiving and how they've been spending their expenses. So we do our best to determine that as well. And it's also harder to get collection on that because you need to find some cash somewhere. And some people are very sophisticated moving their money around, so we can't find the money as easily to garnish. So that kind of gives you a perspective, I hope.
Mm-hmm. No, that helps a lot. One of the, and this will be my last example from last night's reception with CPAs, because that's certainly no way to draft laws from a cocktail party. But one of the comments that was made actually by all of the group was that sometimes they found that there are folks that aren't filing year after year. One mentioned that he had a client that's now in year four of not filing, and he said to that client, if you want me to work with you, now this is it.
Mm-hmm.
But that there wasn't, they've gotten accustomed to just not filing, and there's a comfort level because they haven't seen any problem at this point with their behavior, other than their CPA saying, you're going to lose me as your CPA at that point. And I don't know how prevalent that is. They seem to give me the sense that it was more prevalent than I would be, that I would predict, of clients of theirs that just aren't filing and haven't seen the penalty to that behavior.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the one really troubling aspect about that is they haven't seen it yet. Once we do become aware of them, they probably have an issue with the IRS as well, because the IRS does share their information with us. That's how we find many of the non-filers in Oregon. So if the IRS finds them, they have very punitive penalties as well. And if we find them, as I say, 3 years of not filing is 100% penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And we will waive it for cause or for reason, but we may not. So there are some real heavy ramifications that come down, and we can go back several years as well. So those taxpayers are kind of on borrowed time, really. We really work with the CPAs and the licensed tax practitioners and the tax community to work with them. If they know clients like that, it's in the client's best interest as well to bring them to the department's attention, and maybe we can work something
out. How do we find those folks? Other than communicating with the CPAs and others, what other means do we have of identifying?
We have a lot of data matching that we do. We get information from the IRS. We get a lot of information on income and other sources. So we do a lot of data matching. We have a whole group of people that that's our work, administrative specialist ones, that do the data matching to find people who have not filed and have not paid. And then once we find them, we'll assess them and go after them as well. So we do... We do have a very active filing enforcement program for the tax programs as well. And we find a lot of people all the time. The challenge is, once you find them, getting them to come forward and taking some responsibility for filing and taking care of it, so we don't have to just collect the money involuntarily from them.
Mm-hmm.
And every year we're going to have to be working with them on that piece. So just because they're getting by with it so far doesn't mean that they've got a blank check and are not free ride here, because we will find them.
And there was the indication that these were mainly S-Corps, small businesses. But your, I guess your testimony is that it is not as pervasive, that it's a pretty small group.
Mr. Chair, I would be really interested if we did have information, obviously, about these non-tax-paying people that are working with their CPA, because that's a concern right there. The CPAs do have an obligation as part of their work to ensure their clients are filing and paying. But small business, as I mentioned, that is a difficult piece of it, because there is an ability to hide a lot more because you don't have that employer-employee relationship. We talked a little bit about the withholding system. The withholding system is really a very good safeguard for getting the money in up front, because it's the employer's responsibility to withhold your taxes. So we get the money in up front. Even if you never filed as a taxpayer, we've at least got your payment of your income taxes. But as the small business person, if you're self-employed, that type of thing, there you have to pay your money as estimated tax. And especially if you're financially on the edge, there's sometimes an incentive not to pay that estimated tax, and you get behind. And it's harder for us to figure out how much tax you really owe.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have access to a lot of information. And it's become a higher priority again with the IRS, too. We've noticed that they're much, much more active in filing enforcement than they've been in prior years, too. So they're sharing a lot of information with us.
Yeah. I mean, it's ultimately a fairness issue where you have
really
one
is.
Business or individual, the neighbor, paying, and they have to pick up the freight of that neighbor that doesn't, ultimately. And so it kind of just boils down to ensuring fairness. I don't know how often, perhaps you do, in the last 2 years we've had to seize property or go to court or take those measures, to, which is really the stick side of tax compliance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that data?
We could get it for you, Mr. Chair. We do a variety of actions. We do things like TILTAPs for small businesses. If they haven't been paying, we can go in and actually, through the sheriff's office, take the proceeds that are in the cash register at that time. So there's some of those things.
How often is that?
We do that rarely, because we really do want to get people to do this voluntarily if we can. We can actually work with licensing boards to suspend people's occupational and professional licenses. We do that every so often as well. So that basically they've lost their ability to legitimately earn a living. So that's a very big stick that we have as well. You touched upon fairness. It's amazing. We get a lot of tips from people who know or have reason to believe that their employer or their neighbor or someone they know is not filing and paying, and so we follow up on that. Because it is a voluntary system, and people are willing to comply if they know what the money, more willing to comply if they know what the money is being used for, and also if they believe and know that everyone else has to pay their fair share of the taxes. So there's that piece about we need to make sure we get the revenue collected to fund those services, but we also need to ensure fairness within the system, too. So sometimes these people that owe many years of back taxes, you know, we think, gee whiz, this is like, you know, pulling it out of them. But it's very important that they do not get away with noncompliance, because then they represent a bad example to everyone else. Well, you know, Joe doesn't have to file, and he's getting away with it. Why should I do this?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a bad piece of it. We need to make sure that people realize you do have to file. This is not a choice. You know, you have to file. You have to pay. And we will work to make sure you do it with the tools we have available.
Mm-hmm. That issue is really bubbling up in Multnomah County, where they have this income tax, which the collection on it is they're having difficulties with, and the percentage that aren't participating makes it hard on the folks, and certainly sticks in the crawl of folks who are paying that, and we just don't want to see the same dynamic take place at all in the state, or if there's actions we need to take here while we're in session to ensure. Other questions for our panel, or concerns, or comments? Paul? Well, thank you. This has been really helpful to set the table for the coming days that we have, and the expertise that that you provide is very, very helpful to us as we look towards drafting a bill on this and getting started.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to meet with you, and you all know Deborah very well. When you have questions, please contact her, and she will make sure that the right place in the agency gets the answer developed and back to you and to your staff.
Great.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
So tomorrow we have two or three panels of invited testimony, and then we'll just open a public hearing on this, and we might have to extend the public hearing till Thursday, but would like to have for the committee at least some ideas on paper, which Paul has named as a committee bill, to start looking over and thinking about and weighing amendments by Thursday. And we'd be interested to get the Department of Revenue's perspective if we start moving quickly on this.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Brzezinski.
Committee bills, would they be due on the same day? Oh, I guess we still introduce them, but I was just thinking about getting them drafted. I think Wednesday's our deadline for LC.
Yes. And this one we're teed up on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, we have a bill prepared that's relating to tax compliance. It's largely a vehicle for you to work with, but it's has proper relating clause and has an amnesty program described in it.
Great. With that, we are completed for today, and thank you for the good hearing. We're adjourned.